Blog Talk Radio.
You have made it to Stu and the Nun, an online radio show that looks to inform, educate, and hopefully make you laugh. Stu and the Nun is a show focused on national security, policy, politics, and selfless service. We do this by not only interviewing guests, but also sharing our perspectives and asking you, the listener, to interact with us on our show chat room, via our Facebook page, and on Twitter. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Stu and the Nun. Here, I'm Stu here. I am glad to welcome you to episode 36 of Stu and the Nun tonight on this Tuesday evening, April 26th, yet another hot political night. Nun and I couldn't have picked a better night to do this show with this campaign season because it seems every Tuesday there is something going on somewhere. And with that, I want to welcome, I don't have the Nun with me tonight, but I have a very good friend, and I've known him for quite a while. He's infamous in all kind of circles, and even much more so because just last week he was our guest here on Stu and the Nun, my good friend, Mr. David Bellabia. Hey, Dave, how you doing?
Hey, I am fantastic. It's such an honor that I could fill in because Toby has been fired, and I will be taking on his position from here on out. And no, Toby's going to be back next week, and everything will be right in your universe. But I'm honored to be the fill-in. That's really cool. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. You know, you did offer to come on for half the salary, so I'm yet to figure out what is half of zero. But whatever that is, I mean, that's a pretty good offer.
We'll work it out, I'm sure. My people are on it, so we'll have a deal very soon. But We got the big primary night is tonight. They've called it Super Tuesday so many times that I think we're almost past New Hope now. I think it's like Super Tuesday 8.
It's almost like a bad – it's like Rocky, The Hangover, or I don't know what. But there's a lot of sequels to the Super Tuesday.
There are, and the worst thing about it is that it almost – at this point, it kind of seems like, in the old days, we had people arguing that we had 17 people on the Republican side. There was only really 4 on the Democratic side. And everyone just kept saying, hey, you know, it's not going to happen for you. Get out, get out. You kind of got to look at Kasich and Cruz right now and say the same thing. I mean, what's the point of hanging in if you have no mathematical chance to get to the magic number?
Right, right. I hear you. If you are on the Google Hangout, if you would not mind muting your mic, that would be awesome. You can be on, but just mute your mic would be great, just so we don't have any feedback. But, it is. You know, this is supposedly going to be it tonight. They're saying it's coming down to the wire. And, this is going to be the one that makes all the decisions and people are going to drop. But, I don't know, the people that are, the Sanders and the Kasiches and the Cruises are all saying they're not going anywhere until their convention. So, but then again, Rubio was interviewed the night before he dropped and said he wasn't going anywhere. And the next day he dropped. So, it'll be interesting to see, but I am, I gotta say, man, we're not even really into it yet. But it feels like we've been in this election season forever and I'm really done with it already. I don't know about you.
Yeah, it does. It feels like the second term of the election season for sure. We got and Pennsylvania, Connecticut, and Maryland just were called for Donald Trump, and that's really no shocker there. But again, this is going to be a good day for Trump in the Northeast. It's pretty much the same sort of constituency that he won last week, or I should say the last primary in New York. These are pretty much Trump people. So it really comes down to, for Cruz, he's saying everything's all about Indiana, which, by the way, that's the first time I've ever heard that in my life. It's the first time I've ever heard someone say the future is on the apex of Indiana.
Yeah, I guess at the moment, right? It all seems to be tied to a particular moment in time. But yeah, it is. You're right. This is like a, I don't know. I'm trying to think of some analogy or something. But it's like a never ending song or never ending something that just. It's kind of like a Jerry Lewis telethon, but it just lasts like 18 months. I mean, it never goes away. You know, I put up a little meme I made this morning. I put it up on Facebook. I went and created one. It was pretty much, you know. What did the news used to cover before the election? I forget what the news was because there doesn't seem to be anything but election news. Like, I wonder what they talked about. I guess it was kittens and trees or something, but I can't even remember. It's been so long.
Well, yeah. Meanwhile, you know, the president has sent, we got 5,000 troops now in Iraq and another 250 just went to special operatives and went to Syria. And that's like totally under the radar. No one's talking about that at all.
Right. You know, some of the leaders are, some of the retired generals are who know what a farce. I mean, I saw that 250 troops. I'm like, what are they doing, a parade or like what is that supposed to do?
Yeah. In my old unit, 250 troops could set up an OE-254. That was pretty much all we could do with 250. I mean, it's not a whole lot of support on the ground if something were to go sideways. And you know, I mean. Just using those special operatives like that doesn't seem like you can get much done.
Yeah. I mean, you know, back in the day, it took about 250 to set up a jump talk, you know, and when you mentioned 5-4, a couple of sick-ups or talk extensions or whatever era you came from. But, you know, yeah, it was it's not much. I just hope they send them over with big bags of Tootsie Rolls because that's the only candy that, you know, anyone wants to throw out because it's super cheap. So for when they do the parade there. But, yeah, it's but you're right. There's a lot of stuff happening in the news, and like usual, we're gonna talk about that at the end. Maybe do a little ranting like Toby and I typically do. But before we get to that, you know, we're gonna have our guest joining soon. I want to talk a little bit about our guest and what an interesting gentleman this is, Mr. Matt Zeller. He's a co-founder of an organization he started called No One Left Behind. He's the founder and CEO. Matt was an ETT, Embedded Training Team member, just a short while after I was doing that, in the same area, actually, and in the same neck of the woods, so he stomped on some of the same dirt, and went over there and served next to Afghan forces, security forces, and came back and realized what many of us, even before him, had realized, which is that the interpreters, we refer to them as TERPs for short, not only in Afghanistan, but Iraq, how much they sacrificed, how much they risked, even though they made good money, but how much they put on the line to do that job to help American forces. And it looks like he's pretty much devoted his life now to helping them get resettled and get over in the United States to safety and all that. So we're very interested in talking to Matt. I mean, it's a great organization, what he's doing. I mean, having been in the same area, I get it. And, you know, probably maybe worked with some of the same TERPs he did. I don't know. David, I know you dealt with TERPs in Iraq, and I'm sure you probably had some of the same type of experiences with them. What kind of people they are there?
Yeah, you know, I was a part of a team that brought home two of our interpreters in 2004. The last one got into the country in 2013. It took 9 years to get this guy home to the United States. You know, we talk about interpreters and people, there tends to be, we got to vet these guys. We're not talking about refugees. We're not talking about people that are just raising their hand saying that they want to come to America. These individuals have, you know, helped. Not only do they stood side by side with American warriors, but a lot of times their lives and their families' lives are at stake. And they're threatened on a daily basis because of their allegiance to the United States. And bringing them over here isn't just something that we give as a lifetime achievement award. Oftentimes, it's to save their life.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so it is a great thing. And it looks like we have Matt called in. So usually I go into the green room. I take him in there and just check with him. But I want to get him right on. It looks like the right area code for where I'm expecting him to call from. So with that being said, I'm just going to roll the dice and hopefully this is him and not some heckler or Donald Trump or someone calling in to pontificate on our show, which would be really cool if any of that happened. But anyways, I would like to welcome to the show Mr. Matt Zeller. Matt, is that you?
That's me. I that would have been interesting if it had been Donald Trump, though, huh?
That would have been cool. We may have had to keep you on hold for a few more minutes, so that would have been the case.
I probably would have been, yeah, I'm used to getting bumped by just about everyone else in life, so I would have understood.
Hey, well, welcome, man. Really great to talk to you, and we're so happy to have you on the show. Thank you for giving us a little bit of your time this Tuesday evening.
Gentlemen, it's a pleasure. I'm honored to be here.
Yeah, so, Matt, you you know, you have started this organization, and you've kind of had, you had some, you were an embedded training team member, or ETT, in 2008 in Afghanistan, and you got to work very close with Afghan forces you were mentoring, and then Afghans that worked with you to help you do your job. I guess kind of give us a little bit about that, if you wouldn't mind. Give Dave and I a little bit of your background on that, and kind of what brought you, or what motivated you to one day get up and realize that you needed to start No One Left Behind?
Sure. Well, again, thanks for having me on the show. You're correct. I was what's called an embedded combat advisor, or part of the embedded training teams in ETT. If you were in Afghanistan or Iraq, they were called MIT teams. My job on our team was supposed to be the intel guy. So I was supposed to go over and train all of the Afghan army and police personnel in our area of operations, which is about the size of West Virginia, sort of down towards the Pakistan border in the southeastern part of Afghanistan, in a province called Ghazni. It was my job to train all of their intelligence soldiers and police how to do their job so that one day, hopefully, our military could come home and they could continue on taking the fight to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. My 14th day in country, which is actually will be 8 years ago, 2 days from now. So 2 days from now is what I call my alive day. My 14th day in country, I was on a 15-man patrol, three vehicles, out to assess a police outpost. When on the way back to our FOB, we got ambushed by about 50 Taliban. And they started off this ambush by blowing up our lead vehicle with a pretty large IED. And it was to the point where the vehicle actually had its entire front engine block sheared off. And the five guys who were riding inside were saying their prayers and thanks that they were riding in an MRAP and not a Humvee. Because if they had been in a Humvee, they would have been dead. But the MRAP's designed to take a blast like that. Thankfully, they were all alive. They had horrific concussions. A couple of them didn't know where they were, how to fire their weapon. And so our SOP at that point was to take a thermite grenade and throw it in the back of this vehicle and essentially blow it up, destroy all of the classified equipment. Because at this point, you know, the thing couldn't be towed away. It was the $1.3 million paperweight that we were going to leave on some guy's front lawn as a giant heaping pile of burning metal. What we didn't know at the time was that the MRAP was such a valuable vehicle and that spare parts were so rare that even if this vehicle would never be driven again, its rear tires still work and its back door still works and some of the seats were still usable. And so they would actually, you know, basically they had planned to cannibalize it for parts. And so the order came down that we had to protect this blown up vehicle until the Army could send in this other specialized piece of equipment called a wrecker, which is essentially an armored tow truck, to pick it up and drag this thing back to our main base. And so we put ourselves into this big circle of guys getting out of the vehicles, digging foxholes, getting in those fighting positions, and essentially putting a big circle, making a giant perimeter around this blown-up vehicle, knowing very well that at some point, you know, we were in an open field sloping down towards a village with a lot of cover and concealment for the enemy, meaning the enemy had the ability to hide in buildings that were, you know, in the village off in the distance. They had a wood line they could utilize to mask their approach and attack at us, and they had a ridge line that was actually above us. So we were not in a very good place to be. We knew it was only a matter of time before we were likely hit. So we were trying to fortify our defensive position as much as possible. And really long story short, about an hour into this waiting game that we were doing. What we had been doing for that hour since the initial explosion and when the ambush actually really kicked off was we were rotating one guy at a time off of the perimeter to get in the back of my vehicle and essentially get 5 minutes of air conditioning. Because even though it was the end of April, it was already about 110 degrees over there. And, you know, you're wearing a lot of body armor and you're sweating profusely. So we were trying to cool guys down, get them about 5 minutes of AC, and also honestly give them a chance to grab as much ammo and water as they could carry back to their foxhole. Because we were trying to fortify our defensive perimeter one guy at a time, making it stronger and stronger and just getting stronger and stronger while minimizing the number of people we were pulling off of the perimeter. Because we only had 15 guys on this whole patrol, and we had a pretty sizable piece of terrain that we were trying to secure. And so it just happened to be dumb luck that an hour into this, it was my turn. Just we had been going clockwise around the circle, and so it was my turn to get in the back of the vehicle and get 5 minutes of air conditioning. And I went to get in the back of this MRAP, and in the back was our translator for that mission, this guy named Fareed. And Fareed had been in the vehicle that had been blown up by the IED, and it was the sixth IED blast he had survived at that point in his service. He hadn't been wearing his helmet or his harness, so when the explosion happened, he was essentially catapulted with all of its force into the ceiling and had a horrific concussion, to the point where my medic was essentially playing patty cake with him, trying to, you know, tell him jokes, whatever he could do to keep him conscious, because we all knew that if Fareed went unconscious, one, it was a medical issue to him, but two, he was the only guy who could communicate with the villagers to tell them to stay away, because we all knew, again, we could just tell something bad was going to happen. And so I got in the back of the vehicle, and Fareed looks at me, and he goes, "I have to go take a leak." And I looked at our medic, and I said, "You know, Sergeant Mason, you got to go with him." And as they were getting out of the back of the vehicle, I realized I was going to be back there by myself, and I didn't really need the 5 minutes of AC I had. The bullets and water with me, and so I was just going to walk back to my hole as quickly as possible. But I wanted a cigarette first, and since I couldn't light it up myself, I asked Fareed to put one in my mouth and light it for me as I was getting out of the back of the vehicle. And as I was doing that, I'll never forget, Scott said something along the lines of, like, "Hey, isn't that guy?" And the next thing Scott was pointing to a guy on a motorcycle on the ridgeline who had the binoculars and the radio. And what he was indicating was that this Taliban forward observer had reconned our position about 20 minutes prior from the other direction. And there he was now, basically 180 degrees from where he had been previously, overlooking us. And as Scott said that, there was an explosion behind me. And the next thing I remember, I was on the ground wondering why the dirt was jumping in front of my face, because I didn't understand how there was jumping dirt in Asia, but yet there it was. And then as, you know, the sound came back to me, I realized it wasn't dirt that was jumping, it was bullets basically striking the ground in front of me. And this firefight would go on for the next hour, and I would run out of grenades and run pretty low in my bullets for my M4. And I'm telling you all this horrible day of my life that I normally don't share for the following reason. When seemingly, basically, I was convinced I was going to die, I had a mortar round that had landed next to me and sent me flying into a foxhole. I came to consciousness, looked at my watch, said it was 1650 hours on April the 28th, 2008. I was 26 years old, and I started saying my last prayers and getting ready to just go out fighting. When somebody yelled, "Zeller, don't shoot to your six, there's friendlies to your rear," and I turned and I saw these three up armored Humvees driving like bats out of hell, coming straight out of the village. And the lead vehicle got right up next to me, and the driver's side door flung open, and it was one of our sergeants, this guy from South Carolina. He's got a pretty thick, you know, thick Southern drawl. And so he said, "Hey, sir, I hear you're in a pickle. I brought a Mark 19 grenade launcher. Where do you want it?" And I pointed at the ridgeline and basically said, "Everything up there's got to die." And I then directed them to go assault the ridgeline, and I will freely admit to at this point losing my military bearing, because we had been taking the majority of our fire from that ridgeline, and I wanted to see the two Mark 19 grenade launchers in the 50 cal that they had brought with them essentially kill everybody up there. And so I turned my back on my field of fire to watch these guys assault the ridgeline, and the next thing I remember is somebody just shoulder-checking me like you would do to somebody in a hockey game against the boards. And he nailed me, and I went flying back into the hole I had just sort of crawled out of. And the next thing I hear is the unmistakable sound of an AK-47 going off right next to my head. And I turn, and it's this Afghan man wearing old U.S. Army fatigues, the BDUs. And he's standing over me, looking down at me, and I'm looking up at him, and I'm thinking, is this guy A&A? And so I asked him, you know, who in the heck are you? And he looked back down at me, and he said, I'm Janice. I'm one of those translators. You're not safe. And as he pulled me out of the hole, I looked past him, and that's where I saw the bodies of the two guys that he had just shot and killed, saving my life. Had this guy not been there and been my guardian angel at that moment, these two Taliban fighters had been sneaking up on me. They'd come around this Kalat wall, and Janice described them as like moving like a tiger. They basically even crouched down with their weapons drawn. They had a bead either on my back, or they could have, you know, bum-rushed me, and God only knows what would have happened. But Janice saw that he was in that rescue convoy. As the lead vehicle drove off to assault that ridgeline, he was doing his 5s and 25s in the rear of the vehicle and noticed these two guys running around the corner of this wall and just jumped out and ran full speed, knocking me back into this hole, and then just started shooting at them. I owe my life to
wow,
my
so it's
a translator.
Yeah, that was definitely, you know, and there's no shortage of stories like that, especially coming out of Afghanistan where, you know, the ETT mission was a little bit different than the MIT mission in the fact that there weren't partnered brigades per se. So you were really out there hanging it out there with a couple of Terps if you were lucky. And you know, they were by far more trained and educated than any of the A&A were. So it's that is I guess he also probably could probably learn a little hockey if he was the one to put the check on you.
Yeah, absolutely. He's actually a ringer when it comes to volleyball. A word of advice, if an Afghan ever challenges you to a game of volleyball, it doesn't matter how short they are, they have the highest jump you'll ever see in your life. They're all Olympic quality volleyball players for some reason.
That is interesting. I never knew that, but I never asked mine to play, so that's a good thing. So you came back, Matt, you came back and you probably saw what I saw, which was there was no, unless they were like a Terp for a general officer or something, there didn't seem to be any good or definitely fast way for these guys to get out of country and their families out of country, back here. So is that what kind of brought
right,
you
yeah,
to the point
so
of creating it?
I asked him the next morning. I didn't even know the guy's name. I mean, I had met him 10 days prior. He was not my assigned translator at that point. He became my assigned translator literally the next day when I went to the senior officer on our team and said, sir, I'd like that guy to be glued to my side for the rest of the tour. But I asked him, you know, why'd you do this? And he looked at me like I'd asked him why the sky was blue. And he said, you're a guest in my country. You've given up all of your freedom and safety and everything that's wonderful about America to come to basically, you know, this place to take care of a bunch of people that you've never met before. He's like, I am honor bound to ensure you go home safely to your family. And so I told him I owed him a life debt and that if he ever needed me to repay that, he could ask for anything to include, I would commandeer an aircraft to come and pick him up. And I fully meant that. I would have done something massively illegal to save the dude's life if I had to. That's how much I felt I owed him. And so he laughed, and he said he'll never come to that. And he said, if anything, you're going to come back and visit me as a guest in my own country. I said, I'd love to do that. Well, a year later, I'm home, and he calls me up, and he says, brother, it turns out the Taliban have a publicized hit list. And we knew this because there were bounties on some of, you know, the senior American, you know, folks in country. We essentially find some propaganda from time to time with listed bounties of known and named U.S. officers or coalition partners and senior government officials. But apparently they also published a list of local Afghans that they were going after. And he is, I asked him at this point, you know, when I got home in late 08, early 09. And so it was just around this time, just by sheer serendipity, that Congress passed two laws that essentially created a very large, in terms of allocated numbers, visa programs for Afghans and Iraqis who served as our TERPs. And the rules are essentially as follows. One, you have to prove to the State Department that you've provided you, i.e. the Afghan or the Iraqi, who's applying for one of these visas. You have to prove that you've given at least 1 year of what's deemed honorable and valuable service to the U.S. military while at a time of war. And the only way that you can prove that they will even take is it has to be on official government letterhead, so official memorandum for the record, either for the Army, the Navy, the Marines, the Air Force, the Coast Guard, or a civilian counterpart, you know, State Department, CIA, FBI, et cetera. Official government record basically saying so-and-so worked for me in the following capacity from X date to Y date. Those dates have to add up to a year. The service must again be deemed both honorable and valuable. There are certain criteria that have to be listed. If they clear that hurdle, the next hurdle they have to clear is they have to prove that they've given it, that because of that service, they're in duress, meaning someone is actively trying to harm or hurt them and their family. And then they pass that, the third and by far the most cumbersome hurdle, is they have to pass a national security background investigation that is conducted by every single three-letter agency that you would assume and hope would be involved in the process. Each entity in that has to do their own investigation. It is not coordinated amongst each other, and the average time it takes to get through it is 3 to 4 years, and it must be a unanimous decision. So, you know, say FBI, CIA, NSA, the State Department, and the Department of Homeland Security all sign off on somebody, but the DEA says no, that person never gets to come to the United States ever for the rest of their lives. It's the most stringent immigration criteria that we ask of anyone seeking to step foot on our country for any given period of time. And as I like to remind people, you know, who ask me about this, these aren't just people who walked up to the wall overseas and yelled, "Hey, I speak English." And we were like, "Yeah, come on in. Here's a gun. Go on patrol." They were polygraphed every 6 months. Their phones were listened to. Their emails were read. These guys had no rights to privacy, and we trusted them to, in some cases, we armed them and asked them to wear American uniforms and you know, conduct themselves essentially almost as American service personnel. And that has left, you know, I mean, that's a big deal to these people because they are essentially blacklisted. They're, for all intents and purposes, they can't remain in their countries. If they stay in Iraq, they're either going to be they'll be killed either by ISIS, or if they're a Sunni, they'll be killed by a Shia militia, and if they're a Shia, they'll be killed by ISIS or one of the Sunni militias. If they're in Afghanistan, I remember very clearly. So my translator, 2009, calls me up and he says, "I'm on the top of the Taliban's publicized hit list for the province of Ghazni. There's a pretty large bounty next to my name. My photo is being distributed. They know who I am. I'm being transferred to Kabul." And I asked him, "Do you want to apply for a visa?" And he said, "Yeah, probably a good idea." So we submitted an application thinking naively it would take 6 months to a year. And 4 years later, so 2013, we were still waiting for the damn visa. And at that point, he had become the senior translator on a very large base in Kabul called Camp Black Horse, which is where we did most of the military training for the Afghan army in Kabul, and particularly their senior leadership, right? And so Janice was in a very safe base, and one of the privileges of being a translator is you get to live on the base, sometimes with, if you're very trusted, with the Americans. And so as long as he was employed as a translator, he was safe and secure. What you should know is that from 2011 to 2013, it was so dangerous in Kabul for him to live there that he actually didn't leave the base he was stationed on and go the 1 kilometer down the road to his family's house because of the number of Taliban hit squads that the U.S. intelligence officer came and warned him about, basically saying, "They're waiting for you at any time to leave. You can't go." And so for 2 years, he didn't see his daughter for the first 2 years of his life, of her life. He was there for her birth, and then he saw her again when we were getting him his visa, and he was told, okay, your visa's secure, quit your job, pack your stuff, you're going to America in 2 weeks. That was the next time he saw her. And so in this time, he's working as a translator still. He's still, you know, the bounty is only increasing on his head. And then this following thing happens. It's summer of 2013, and I'm actually, you know, at this point home, in the reserves, not really thinking quite honestly about, you know, his case every single day. It's certainly on the back of my mind, but, I just figured it was progressing through the system at a glacial pace at that, but it was going. When he writes to tell me that he's being laid off because of the U.S. drawdown, like so many translators, as we withdrew our forces over there, their services were no longer required. And so they were being laid off. And here was the critical point. This is what absolutely convinced me that even Afghans can't remain in Afghanistan if they've served with us. If Janice said that the Afghan army guys on the base that he was a translator for came to him because he was the sort of senior translator for the 300 or so other translators that lived on this base. And they came to him, they said, you have two options. When the Americans leave at the end of October, you and all the translators can go with them and go back and live in your homes. Or we're going to sell you to the Taliban because that will make us good with the Taliban and they won't attack us. And this was important, it's because we believe you're all American spies and collaborators. And so there's Afghan translators are now being blacklisted by their own countrymen. And it's not that the Afghan army is turning on the U.S. military, the U.S. presence. I think they're seeing the writing on the wall. And for them, there's, you know, Afghans sometimes play both sides, and this is a way of sort of hedging one's bet. Janice's own family members, extended family members, have since written him and said, if you ever come back to Afghanistan, we are by religious decree, you know, by our honor, supposed to kill you. And these are not obviously close family. These are distant cousins and people he hasn't seen in, you know, years. But that's the reality, is that that anybody who has seen, who have worked for the Americans, and it's not just translators, if you were a guy folding laundry, the very fact that you were on a daily basis walking in and out of a gate that went to an American base, the Taliban doesn't know if you were folding laundry or if you were the lead informant that was, you know, literally scouting Osama bin Laden's position in Pakistan for the CIA. They're going to treat you as, even if you were the guy doing the laundry, they're still going to kill you in the same way as they would if they could get their hands on whomever they believed would be to an informant or a translator. And look, these are not, it's not a bullet to the back of the head. This is brutal. Torture,
right,
horrible
right.
death, often, by the way, and this is the key point, often filmed, and this is why I do, so this is why we founded this organization. Janice gets here to America in October of 2013. I picked him up from the airport, and I learned at the airport that they're allowed to bring one suitcase per family member. It has to be under 50 pounds and fit in the overhead flight bin. And so Janice packed, like, the family Quran, the only black and white photo of his father that he owns in life, and the family heirlooms that they're never going to sell, regardless of how hard it is in America, because that's all of his heritage that he has to pass on to his son and his daughter. And they can't, that was it. They didn't have winter clothing or anything. And I learned at the airport that there's not even a government program in place to take care of these people when they arrive. They're abandoned at the airport. And it was incumbent upon me to find him a house and furnish it and get him a car and a job and explain to him how he pays his taxes and get his kids enrolled into school and his wife into English classes. And, look, gentlemen, I'm not a wealthy guy. So I tried to crowdsource it. I had a pretty good media coverage going at this point. CBS News had sent out a camera crew to film his arrival. And so I asked, you know, the reporter, if she wouldn't mind sharing with the world when they made the report the next day on live TV with, you know, Charlie Rose, they wouldn't mind telling folks that this guy had arrived with nothing, and we were trying to raise him some money to pay for his first month's rent. Well, 3 days later, I go to check the bank account that we had set up to accept funds, and there's $35,000 in it, almost from complete strangers. So I go to my brother's because you got to understand, at this point, Janice and I are family. That's my brother. I mean, for the rest of my life, that's my brother. His kids are my niece and nephew. His wife is my sister-in-law. My daughter is his niece. We celebrate every holiday, both Afghan and American together, Muslim and Christian together, all birthdays, family events, you name it. He's in weddings. I'm in weddings. That man is a full-blooded member of my family and vice versa. So I went over to his house to check up on him and to bring him, honestly, what I believed was a gift from the American people. You see, I've been telling you thus far just about his experience with me. What I learned during the process to get him his visa is that I'm actually one of five American soldiers that can point to that man and say, he saved my life in a firefight. And I didn't know any of him before the effort to get him his visa. No, I take that back. I knew one guy. He's from Syracuse. His name is Ben Tupper. Ben and I were out to dinner once getting a beer in 2009, right after I got back from the war, and I started telling Ben about how my TERP had saved my life in a firefight, and Ben stopped me and goes, wait a minute, what province? I said, Ghazni. He goes, what was the guy's name? I said, his name was Janice. He goes, that guy was my TERP in 06. He shot a guy who jumped over a wall who was about to shoot me in the back, and then he beat him to death with the butt of his rifle. That guy's awesome.
Yeah.
He'd saved five American lives in combat. He did 8 years on the front lines, as far as I'm concerned. And so to me, that makes him, as more of a veteran than I am. Because I only did one tour. He did eight. I had the luxury of leaving. He had to go to the next unit, the next mission. And so I go to his house, and I sat him down, and I said, brother, I have a gift here from the American people. It's an in thanks in exchange for your 8 years of frontline combat service. And it's a check for $35,000. And it's enough to cover all of your rent for the next year and your groceries. And so this is a guy who was born the year before the Soviets invaded. His whole life has been war. They lost everything when the Soviets invaded. They got it. They built it back, and then they lost it all again in the Civil War. And they were trying to build it back when the Taliban came and took it all away. And so he and his family spent 7 years, 22 people, living in a one-room shack in a UN refugee camp until our military liberated their country from the Taliban, and they went back literally the next day after Kabul fell to American forces to find that their ancestral home had been stripped bare down to even the wiring and piping had been pulled out of the walls. They had nothing. So here's a guy who, once again, has nothing in his life. He's sitting in almost a barren apartment, and I'm handing him a check for $35,000. He honestly thought about accepting it for maybe half of a heartbeat. And he said, brother, I can't take the money. I said, what do you mean you can't take the money? What do you want me to do with it? And that's when he looked me right in the eye. And he said, what about Hassan and Latif and Fareed and Jamshid and Maiwand and Habib? He was naming all the other translators, all the other TERPs from our FOB. I said, what about them? And that's when he looked me right in the eye and he said, don't they deserve to be here too? He had a really good point. They did. So I asked him, what do you want me to do with the money? And he said, can we use it to start an organization to do for them what you've done for me, to help get them their visa, pick them up from the airport, find them a place to live, pay the rent for a couple of months, furnish their home at no cost to them, help them get a car and a job and integrate into the community around them. And that was the birth of No One Left Behind. And then, gentlemen, I'll tell you, our original goal was to get those six guys out and be done. We're still waiting to try to get the last two. They're still waiting on their visas. But in that interim, we've expanded and grown a little bit. We're now in eight cities across the country. We resettled 1,300 people last year alone. We're going to resettle our 2,000th person probably sometime in June or July. And our goal is real simple. The government estimates that there are 35,000 minimum translators and their families who are still remaining left behind in Iraq and Afghanistan. These are people who have qualified and have earned their visas to be here. They are simply waiting on those visas to be adjudicated and issued to them. And when they arrive
here,
unless they have our organization, they have absolutely no base of support whatsoever. And so this is what gets me back to why I think this is imperative to help these people. If they can't stay in their own countries because they're going to get killed there. And if they make it here, the last thing we want them to do is to find that we are so unwelcoming or that it is so impossible for them to integrate into the country around them that they choose to go back home to die. And I know of at least five families now who have gone back to Afghanistan because they've decided that they essentially have ended up homeless in America. One of them panhandled on the streets of Washington, D.C. for 3 months just to save up enough money to buy 4 one-way plane tickets to go back to Kabul. If that becomes the prevailing experience for these guys and they start going home and telling their countrymen, what I fear is the following. I'm not supposed to be here. I'm on borrowed time. I should have died 8 years ago, 2 days from now, 8 years ago, on a hillside in Afghanistan, but I didn't because God sent my guardian angel in the form of an Afghan man. And so I'm trying to do a little bit of good with what time I've been given.
Right. I think Dave's got something for you.
I just wanted to say this one last thing. What would have happened if Janice hadn't believed us when we promised him that if he worked with us, we would either deliver a better Afghanistan or bring him to safety? More importantly, what happens, God forbid, if we go to Syria and we put ground troops in Syria or Mali or Yemen or Libya? We ask those people to stand with us, and they say, you know what, I believe in everything you're trying to accomplish in my country, but there's just one problem. I watched the Afghans and the Iraqis that you told the same thing to a decade ago get beheaded on YouTube, and so I know that working with you is actually a guaranteed death sentence. You don't keep your promises. I can't help you out. I'm sorry. What happens to that poor soldier who goes over there and doesn't have their local translator sticking by their side like I did? You know, I was an NCO before I was an officer, and in both leadership positions, I was told that my job was to take care of soldiers. And one of the last things I was told when I got out of the military is that even though I was taking off that uniform, the job and responsibility of taking care of soldiers didn't end. I need to take care of my brothers and sisters who I'm served with through the rest of their issues, through their life, because they were only able to understand, we're the two, you know, groups of people who understand each other the best forever, regardless of anyone else around us. And more importantly, I need to leave the Army and the country and the world that we are in better for the people who come next, for the next generation. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Gotcha.
Matt, this is David. Listen, we're going to go live in like 2 minutes, and these are amazing stories. Can we get these when we go live on the radio?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, no, I'm just kidding. We've been live the whole time. No,
yeah,
listen, man.
I can repeat all over again.
Right. No, listen to me, dude. What you're doing is actually the Lord's work. It's incredible stuff. These guys, you know, we said it before, you know, when these people are not only taking the enemy's life on the battlefield, saving our lives, but their lives are in danger for doing that. Their families' lives are in danger. And it takes years. There's no, it used to be, you know, two sworn statements and, you know, the commanding officer said these guys were legitimate and supposedly the process would be going, but it takes years. I don't know of any organization like yours. I've never heard of one, and
we're
I got to be
one.
Honest with you. Yeah,
we
no, what you're doing
we're
is
the only one.
What you're doing is incredible work, and for guys like me and I know Troy as well, you know, we've had experience with interpreters that have just done incredible things, and they deserve the right to be Americans because they bled for it. And my hats off to you and what you're doing and all the people you got going. What's the website again?
It's No One Left. That's all one word. So NOONELEFT.org. We've actually got a chapter in Rochester, New York. It is so thriving that we actually just had a family. And this is I should have said this earlier. Here's a clear example of just how screwed up the quote-unquote system that exists to take care of these guys is. This family had been, again, for lack of a better term, resettled. They had been abandoned to Dallas. Okay, they've been flown to Dallas. And by the way, when these guys are flown here, it's not like we pay for the plane ticket. The plane ticket is purchased for them, but they arrive in America in debt. They have to pay back the cost of the flight it takes just to get them here. And so they arrive already several thousands of dollars in debt for these plane tickets. This family had essentially been abandoned to a slum in Dallas and was on the verge of – they were evicted. And so they got on a bus and because they heard through the grapevine that if they made it to Rochester, New York, the No One Left Behind team there would be able to help them out and take care of them. And so here's a family that just out of the blue showed up to Rochester a week ago without any letting any of us know anything. And, of course, we're going to take care of them. We've already found them housing. We've got the home almost entirely furnished. We should have a job for the head of the family in a week, hopefully in a month at the most. We'll have a car for them, and you know, as soon as you can pass a driver's test and get them insured, you know, this is what we do. It comes down to that. We keep people from being homeless. We keep, and again, I look at these guys as veterans. Maybe they weren't born here. Fine. Who cares? Maybe they didn't go to basic training. Fine. Who cares? They picked up a weapon. They did things that only other soldiers did for other soldiers. And I don't care at that point where you placed in the birth lottery. What I care about is what you did when it was time to actually do something that mattered. Take care of the people on your right and left. That's what they did. As far as I'm concerned, they've earned the right to call themselves that, and they've earned a little bit more help than others. That's just how I
feel. No, Matt, you hit a good point. I mean, you know, I was in fact, I know most of the people that were on your team because I was an ETT in 06 to 07 in Ghazni and Pekika. So, I don't know if you may have been in the class. I taught a class at before Drum to a whole bunch of ETTs right before you guys left. I don't know if you were ever in that, but
I was.
You were?
Yeah, I was.
Oh, okay.
So I got attached to I was part of the 27th Infantry Brigade Combat Team, the New York Army National Guard guys that went over in LA.
Right.
Yeah, we did all of our pre-mob at Drum.
Yeah, so I taught a class because I had just gotten back. But, you know, and one of the things I talked about to some of the folks up there, not in that class, but I talked many times, was that, you know, the one people that the Taliban hate worse than Americans are Afghans who help Americans because they consider them the ultimate traitor. So, you know, you hit on a good point. They can't even leave. You know, when they went home on vacation or whatever, they had to change in civilian clothes. They'd leave all their IDs. I mean, just like the military guys did, because – The Taliban would kill them before they killed us if they only had one bullet left. So it is what you're doing is and they did. They may have made better money and they did make very good money compared to an Afghan military. But they
that
also
changed,
were much more skilled.
That changed dramatically after we left, by the way. The average pay of the Afghan translator went down about $100 a year. Starting in 09 all the way to the current year, they make about $300-$400 a month now.
Yeah, it went down. All of my Terps except one is here now. They've all worked their way over, and I stay in pretty close contact with them because I was a senior NCO, so I was responsible for all their leave and pay and benefits and make sure they were good to go. And so they and they told me that, you know, they said it is after about 08, 09, 10, everything dropped way off, and they definitely think it compensated the way they used to, because it really came down to government contracts, and they really didn't have, you know, they didn't have much pull. Is whatever the contract worked out, you know, they became pawns in the system.
You're absolutely right. But you're also totally right about the Taliban would save their last bullet for a Terp. I mean, we used to notice in firefights that the Terps would get shot at first, and often the most highest volume of fire. And it kind of dawned on everybody, of course they're shooting at the one person who's not dressed like the rest of us. Right? You know, you shoot at the guy who's standing next to all the Americans in civilian clothes or the old BDUs, right? So once that started happening, we just started putting all our Terps into ACUs. And then, you know, if they can see that far away, you shoot at the one with probably the beard who, you know, the least American. But at least you're trying to minimize the odds. I mean, Taliban didn't have bullets that magically went around the Afghans to seek out the Americans. They went through the Afghans on their way to the Americans. That's the other thing I try to remind people. And it was often because the Afghan was diving in front of the American to take the bullet.
Right. So it's good. So noonelefthout.org, great mission. People can go there and donate, find out how they can help, that kind of stuff, right?
And I'm going to make this even better for everyone listening. I don't want to do this. I don't want to be in business, all right? Name me a charity that has said, put me out of business as quickly as possible. Our goal is real simple. The government says there's 35,000 of these folks who remain left behind. We want to get them here within 10 years. We figure if we don't do it within 10 years, they're all going to be dead by that point anyway. Because right now, the UN, they just put out a figure. The UN has figured out that one Afghan is killed per day because of their former service to the U.S. And if you were to go to the island of Lesbos, which is in the Mediterranean Sea, it's the Greek island that's closest to Turkey, where all of the refugees that are trying to stream into Europe try to make that dangerous crossing, and a lot of them drown. But they do it because of just how close the island is to the Turkish coast. If you go to the island of Lesbos right now, and I have this from multiple sources, and one of them has to be a MARSOC buddy, a Marine Special Operations buddy of mine, who went there to see it firsthand. The second largest population of people moving through are not Iraqis. It goes Syrians and then Afghans and then Iraqis. ISIS is not nearly in Afghanistan as much as they are in Iraq. So these are people, mind you, there's no easy path to get there. If they go to Iran, Iran has a policy. They will behead a translator at the border if they find out they're a former translator. David Cameron, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, his personal translator was killed in Iran last year trying to cross to Iran on his way to Europe after the British denied him the visa that he had so desperately sought. This is the former translator of the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. So, I mean, like, you know, this is going on. If we don't do this within 10 years, these guys are all going to be dead. And so I've talked to so many Vietnam vets. I'll just leave you all with this last thought. I've talked to so many Vietnam vets. And to a person, when I tell them what's going on, what we're trying to do, they get this look in their eye and they get angry and they say, I can't believe we're doing it again. And that's when I have to remind them, we're not. Not yet. And not if I have anything to say about it, and hopefully the rest of us as well. Because this is honestly, they're right, this is a never again moment in the making. And what I mean by that is, this is one of those moments where if we don't do the right thing, if we don't save these people as we promised them, we're going to look back on it afterwards and go, oh, we got to make sure we never again let that happen. And how many times in our history have we had one of these moments where we, after the fact, have just said, oh, if we'd only done the right thing, well, you know what? This is eminently solvable. All we have to do is have the courage and conviction to do the right thing. And if people think that this is not possible, I'll leave you with these final two things. In Vietnam, in the last week of the war, there's an amazing documentary that PBS did called Last Days of Saigon, in Saigon. And it's about the final week, essentially, of the Vietnam War. And it talks all about the evacuation of Saigon. I'm sure your listeners are instantly thinking about, you know, images of helicopters taking off of the embassy rooftop. Well, it actually was the CIA station at the embassy, but that's beside the point. But that's probably what comes to people's minds. But what a lot of folks probably don't know is in that 1 week alone, we got out anywhere from 100 to 150,000 Vietnamese. And we got them to the Philippines, and within 6 months, they were all resettled in America. And if you look at them as an immigrant population, they are, statistically speaking, the most successful immigrant population in U.S. history. Within a generation, most of their children are either doctors, lawyers, or very well-paid research scientists or in finance. They are almost all entirely homeowners and small business owners, tax-paying, proud, patriotic Americans. And that's what we see these guys as. And we're talking about right now 1/5 of the number of people. And we're trying to do that 1/5 of the number within 10 years, not a week. If we can do it in Vietnam, we can do it now.
Right. Matt, I really appreciate it. I hate to cut you off, but we're about to wrap up on the show. We've just got a couple minutes left. But I want to thank you so much for coming on this Tuesday night, giving us some of your time and letting our listeners know about this and what the issue is and you know where they can find you at.
General, it's a pleasure. I've been honored to speak with you and to address your audience, and I'd be happy. At any time you have me back, I'd be happy back on, and just thanks again for the opportunity.
Hey, no problem. Thank you very much, Matt. You have a good night.
You as well, gentlemen. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, everybody. Matt Zeller from No One Left Behind, noonelift.org. There you go. Everything and anything you wanted to know about what caused it, how it got there, and kind of what the issue is. Dave, what do you got, my friend?
I didn't get the name on that. It sounded like was that the island of Lesbos? Is that what you said?
I think it was the island of Lesbos. I'm not sure why anyone's leaving that island.
I don't know.
Sounds like an island you'd want to stay at. But just saying.
Oh man, yeah. No, I didn't know if that was just a faux pas or if that was an actual place. And if it was an actual place, they are not welcome in this modern military.
Yeah, and may have to go over there and be the LNO, right? Just to help.
No, it's a great, it's a great cause. I don't mean to make light of the cause. It's great, and you know, bringing Terps over here is great. Now, the 35,000 number, that's going to freak some people out. I wouldn't lead with that.
Yeah.
But you know, the actual number of guys that have done some great things that are coming over here, it's fantastic. But then again, we have we have foreign nationals that are joining our military, and
right.
are trying to get citizenship. And that's not even working
out
for them either.
My good friend and fellow co-host, The Nun, is a Canadian citizen who went to war twice for this country and still hasn't been able to get his citizenship. So, you know, it's not even enough. I know, exactly. Hey, we only got about 4 minutes left. I want to make sure we hit on what's going on this weekend that you and I are both part of, especially you. You're inviting me along. But let our listeners know what's happening here in Western New York this weekend.
Yeah, we got the Independence Fund. They're doing the Indy at the Falls in Niagara Falls at the Seneca Niagara Casino on the U.S. side. And, you know, they got a bike run earlier in the day, and then at night they're just doing a gala. This is an organization, Bill O'Reilly, on the O'Reilly Factor. All of his proceeds from his website go to the Independence Fund. They've got Gary Sinise and Dennis Miller are their, you know, superstar faces. But it's a group that puts out about 1,400 of those all-terrain wheelchairs out, and they're starting to do amazing things with some hyperbaric chamber therapies for guys with, basically post-concussion traumatic brain injury.
Right,
a lot of PTS,
right.
rapid eye treatment, just really outside the box. I'm proud to have you there and all your friends, and it's going to be a lot of fun. It's Saturday, and Montgomery Gentry is doing the music.
Yeah, and my good friend and our past guest on this show, Tim Payne, is going to be the keynote speaker. And
That's right.
Excited about Tim, and he's just a great, great dude, and excited to have him be doing that. And you're emceeing the event, and me and my wife and some good fellow vets are just there soaking up your favors and appreciate
you know, the
that.
MC
but, yeah.
The MC role, I will actually be spitting some reps. And it's not just the MC. We'll actually be a young MC, and my album's dropping in a month. But no, I'm looking forward to meeting Tim Payne, and I'm looking forward to have beers with you and Tim coming up here soon too.
Yeah, we're doing that too. So absolutely. Hey, we got about 2 minutes left. We usually do our bald man rants. I know you're not bald, but well, at least not on top of your head. Don't know about the rest of you. So, but anyway, that's for another show. But anything you want to rant about, you got a minute.
You know what? I got nothing. Life is perfect and wonderful, and we got 5 states going for Trump. He just swept the Northeast.
Yep. All right. My only thing is I'm just going to just a quick rant is that this whole Target store thing is just asinine. In 2 days, 700,000 people have signed a petition boycotting Target because they have opened up all their bathrooms nationwide to if you feel like you belong in a certain bathroom, you can go in it. Hopefully, I'd imagine they probably don't have 7,000 transgenders that even go to their stores. So 700,000 people signing it should get the message across. But I mean, it's real simple. They could solve it. You know, there's a lot of those family or whatever bathrooms or whatever, which are just one holers. And you know, like a mother can take a child in there or whatever. So you're not taking a boy in a women's bathroom or vice versa. They could just put one of those in and solve the whole thing and not try to become the poster child of another social experiment. But it's a decent store. I hope they listen to their customers, 700,000 of them. And that's all I wanted to rant about. So.
There's a solution to this, Troy. Just use the aisles. That's what I say.
Yeah. Or go outside. You know, sometimes you just go outside. Yeah. Go pee on that big red Target sign on the front wall. That may get
right.
the attention. All right. Well, hey, thank you so much, Dave, for being guest hosting. You did a phenomenal job. Thank you for everybody on the Google Hangout. I see a lot of you on there. And hopefully it all went well and you guys could hear okay. And thank our guest, Mr. Matt Zeller from No One Left Behind. Great show. Thanks a lot. And Dave, I'll see you in a couple days, my buddy.
All right, man. Take care.
All right. We'll talk to y'all later. Good night.
Thank you for tuning in to Stu and the Nun tonight. We're always grateful for our listeners, both live and those who check us out on the archive. Be sure to check out our website at www.stewandthenun.com and like our page, Stew and the Nun, on Facebook, and follow Stew and the Nun on Twitter. And of course, be sure to join us again next week and every week here on blogtalkradio.com/Stew and the Nun every Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern. You all have a good night.